It's easier, someone once said, to imagine the end of the world than it is the end of capitalism.
But it's clear that what we can make systems of this complexity, cultural systems, economic systems, machines of this complexity, surely we could make a world that could first meet those needs I described that everyone should have, and then perhaps meet needs that people have only dreamed of, like the need for some autonomy and freedom. The need for that little space up there, the eye part, to expand a little bit. Just a little.
Just a little.
Just a little.
Socialism that could engage with the yearnings and dreamings and
Miles Davis music
and aesthetic dimension
radically incompatible with everyday life under capitalism.
Welcome to another edition of the As Seen on Earth podcast. I'm Mike Watson, here as usual with my co-host, poet, artist, and dank memester, Adam Ray Atkins, and two guests, David Blacker, Professor of the Philosophy of Education and Legal Studies at the University of Delaware, and author of What's Left of the World, which came out last year from Zero Books, and YouTuber Big Bread Brains, who is a cultural theorist, multimedia artist, and writer. So let's start with possibly my favourite part of the whole election and aftermath so far, and that's Rudy Giuliani telling everybody in front of a landscape gardening centre in Pennsylvania not to be ridiculous. Okay, so this is possibly the most ridiculous moment in recent political history. The Republicans clearly accidentally booking the Four Seasons landscaping company car park for a speech rather than the Four Seasons, the luxurious and much more prestigious Four Seasons hotel. And Giuliani then having to kind of turn the tables and point out or tell the present journalists that they were in fact the ridiculous ones. Let's just hear that.
This will be a very, very strong case. And I know you won't accept it because of your hateful biases, but let's see if you can try thinking rationally. The poll? Because they don't decide the election. The call for Joe Biden isn't... Who was it called by? Oh my goodness! All the networks! Wow! All the networks! We have to forget about the law! Judges don't count! All the networks! All the networks thought Biden was going to win by 10%. Gee, what happened? Come on, don't be ridiculous. Networks don't get to decide elections. Courts do.
So we have three genuine U.S. citizens here. And I want to ask a first question. Has Trump inadvertently legitimized Biden? In the sense that, I mean, no one really, I think, was believing very strongly in Biden. He was kind of like the kind of never Trump candidate. But then now you have Trump acting like a dictator and thereby casting Biden as a kind of defender of democracy. So is there kind of a notion of Biden emerging now? Is this kind of like a Bedouin event or a Zizekian act? Has Biden been kind of transformed by circumstances or rather the perception of him?
What's crazy to me is like trying to find a single passionate Biden supporter before Bernie dropping out, right? Like no one wanted Biden to win in the Democratic primary. Like literally they didn't wanted fucking anybody else, like Pete, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar. It really didn't seem like nobody really was into Biden until, you know, it was like Biden and Bernie and then Biden and then Bernie dropping out. And then Biden, yeah, is like this fucking hero out of nowhere. You know, like when previous basically like no one was really into it. Like it was actually hard to find anyone that really was like cared about Biden. And yeah, I definitely do think that, like, you know, like the Trump, like, breaking all the liberals' brains, 2016, and, you know, like, and like the whole idea that, like, Trump is a fascist. Yeah, that definitely has to play a role in making Biden seem like a lot more of this hero figure than he actually is.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Anyone else going to go along with that?
I think what Tony is saying makes a lot of sense to me. It certainly fits with my observations and experience over the last year here. I will say, I have to, just one thing on the total Four Seasons Total Landscaping Giuliani clip, which I just couldn't help laughing at again. I do think with Trump, I think you can make the case that of all the stuff he's done, the most indictable offense is to subject all of us to Giuliani, you know, for the last few years. I mean, what a figure, you know. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think. I mean, in my neighborhood, which is probably 90-10, or if not greater for Democrats, there's certainly a lot of Biden yard signs and things sprung up, and you know, you see that. But it's an anti Trump, you know, sentiment. I don't think it's a Biden, and I think that has real consequences as far as the way that power is being divided, is going to be divided probably here, because, I mean, look at the Democrats lost seats improbably, at least against the predictions in the House, you know, and I think it's, I mean, it's like maybe 50-50, but I think it's unlikely the Democrats are going to take control of the Senate, because I think it's, we don't know. It's a weird year. Who knows? But it's probably unlikely those Georgia races are both going to go to the Democrats in their runoff. So, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who seem to have simply voted anti-Trump, and then at least enough of them in certain areas just went back and voted for their usual sort of incumbent Republican congressperson, you know. So we have that kind of split, enough of that split ballot sort of voting to where it looks like, you know, Biden's not going to have, like you said in the intro, Mike, Biden's probably not going to have Congress.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for that. I'm just thinking, I mean, what I'm really seeing at the moment, but this is like in a kind of a tiny part of the online left, is a lot of, as I kind of alluded to in the intro, is a lot of kind of socialist to communist leftists bashing people who voted for Biden. Is this something happening like outside this small portion of the left internet? I mean, is it something happening, playing out in conversations you have with people in daily life?
Yeah. I don't know. I've been seeing some kind of, you know, like when I go and want to look at the, like how Mao says, you know, go and understand the working class, you know, you go on Instagram and look at the, hood memes, Instagram accounts with like millions of followers or whatever. But like, I've been seeing this around. I see this on the street too. Like people talking about like, oh yeah, you need to vote for Biden. You need to vote for Biden. We need to get this fascist out the White House. Like, oh, you know, really pushing that. And then there'll be someone jokingly like, you know, like, you know, these are apolitical people. These people are not into politics at all. Right. And there'll be someone that's like, oh, you know, you're going around saying to vote, but like nothing's going to fundamentally change this and that. I don't think these people are really understanding like the political implications of, you know, how maybe it could be ineffective to vote for the candidate who is not going to do anything for you and prove to the Democratic Party that you're willing to vote for them. I don't think they're like understanding
If I could just add to that, it's not like they're even hiding it. Biden actually said, I think it was during one of the debates, wasn't it, where he actually said, nothing's going to fundamentally change.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And they even like his correct slogan. Him as like, oh, was that a gaffe? And he was like, no, that's, I meant what I said. You know?
Yeah, so I've been kind of seeing that in the kind of, you know, regular people kind of vibe, right? You know, like, it's not just a small little leftist bubble of people that are saying this, right? If that's what you're kind of, I mean, or that's what I think. I've been kind of seeing that in kind of popular culture, you know, people being fucking fed up with this Democratic, you know, liberal bullshit.
So I've seen definitely almost, I haven't run across anyone that seems so happy about Biden himself, but people very happy about Trump's defeat. And I have surprisingly seen people excited for Kamala Harris, which, you know, in the primaries, it seemed like very few people were excited for her. But now that
shit in the primaries.
Right. But now so many people, you know, that I work with are very happy about her. And like people that I run into in coffee shops or like friends from, you know, high school or whatever, people that are barely political or maybe slightly apolitical, you know, they do seem very excited about that. And I think that, yeah, Mike, you're kind of right that the way Trump is behaving, the so like the questioning of the legitimacy of the vote has really somewhat energized some people, like the liberals, energized them to the possibility of a good Biden. Even though they didn't like him or still don't really care for him, you know, their hatred of Trump is being renewed constantly by the stuff that he's continuing to say. While the Democrats are saying, all right, we understand now we need to, you know, like move more center. We have to step away from the leftist portion of our party, you know, like they've come out and said that, even though the numbers don't seem to hold that up at all, because all of the more progressive of the Democrat candidates were the ones that won more easily. You know, and those houses, those seats that were lost, that were the more centrist candidates in the party.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, I mean, what I've been seeing, I say it's a very small portion of the left net, because it's certainly not representative of all of America from my perspective, because I don't know that many Americans. Most Americans I know are in that kind of, you know, kind of left tube, left memeing community. But it's just this kind of thing that keeps coming back, like, you know, a lot of memes saying that, well, they're kind of making fun, but what they're basically saying is like, hey, don't you know that this guy's a neoliberal? It's basically all capitalism.
Was that ever a question that anyone...
Well, that's what I'm saying. Was it ever a question? But it's like, yeah. Adam will testify, and Tony, I mean, the left internet is full of people pointing out that Biden is a neoliberal and saying it as a way of berating many leftists who would have voted for him.
For sure.
He is, of course.
The whole thing that he is, and David's saying is what exactly what I'm saying. It's very obvious, but on the other hand, yeah, it is very obvious, which is what annoys me about the people pointing it out. Yet at the same time, something still needs doing. You know what I mean? The fact that it's obvious doesn't mean that we don't have some kind of problem there. And here's a question: is would Bernie have won? I know you're saying that the left senators increased their votes, but does that mean Bernie would have won? It doesn't necessarily mean that, no, because I mean, you had Biden winning whilst you have left senators increasing their votes, so it doesn't necessarily, you know, it suggests that what happens on a national scale isn't the same as what happens in the Senate vote.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt pretty confident that Bernie would have won in 2016. Rather than Hillary, but this time I'm not so sure. I think it's hard to say. Very hard to say. I mean, Trump outperformed what most people thought. And certainly with certain groups.
People of color. That was fucking hilarious. He killed it with people of color.
Yeah. You wonder, like, I mean, well, Adam, you say you were up in Wayne County, Pennsylvania. I mean, he was these rallies he was having, you know, as the election was closing, I was like, okay, you can't maybe go by rallies, especially with the pandemic time, but that was something. I mean, he really brought people out. I there was a lot more support for him than I thought there was going to be, honestly, personally. And that was really something. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what how Bernie would have fared. I think it's just very, very hard to say.
Yeah.
Well,
Tony, what do you think?
Well, I have like, okay, well, I wanted to touch on the point of like, you know, everybody shitting on like Biden voters or whatever. And I think it's more of like, you know, the idea of like the Democratic establishment, you know, as an apparatus or whatever. And it's like, on the left, we want things like Medicare for all and stuff like that. Right. But, as an apparatus, you know, it's been kind of clear that like, they won't give us these things like Medicare for all if we can prove to them, like if we prove to them that we're going to vote for them no matter what, like if we're going to get all these people to morally say, oh, you're going to let a fascist, you know, win, you're going to let a fascist win. Because, you know, if we can prove to the Democratic Party that we're willing to not vote for them, then that will maybe actually give us some leverage to get policies like Medicare for all passed. Maybe I'm wrong though. Holy shit. I mean, maybe it's more complex than that. I mean, shit, even Trump has like probably better trade policies and shit like that than Biden, but I don't know. I want to hear your guys' thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe just to extend on that a little bit, I think at least to me, it seems like from, you know, the punditry that I've, you know, that we've seen post-election, And I guess you could see this coming. One of the, I think, really weird things that's happening is that from a social class perspective, the Republican and Democratic parties, even though it seems like it wouldn't be this way ostensibly, they seem to be in the process of switching places from
yeah, exactly
point of view. I mean, now I'd say it's in transition. It's not complete, obviously, because you've got like urban working class and stuff is going to be more thoroughly Democratic, but it's in transition. And I don't know, the Republican and Democratic parties have switched places over time in American history before, you know, the last switch was in the early 1960s, right? With the so-called Southern strategy, that Nixon employed, that kind of turned the Dixiecrat Democrats into Republicans, you know? So it's kind of strange. And anytime with this two-party system, right, we've got both Biden and Trump become these fetishized objects almost that kind of, it almost doesn't matter what they are, you know, at a certain point. They become these sort of vessels, these symbolic sort of vessels for these large, I guess, coalitions or amalgamations. And Trump, I mean, Trump has got, you know, it's really striking that the big divide seems to be credential, like college educated or not, right? If you go with educational credentials, Biden and the Democrats are absolutely killing it with the college educated and the credentials, right? And the Republicans are killing it with the uncredentialed, which, by the way, I have to interject, one of my favorite statements of all time in politics was Trump back in, I think it was in 2016. It might have been in the primaries where he said, "I love the poorly educated," you know. But you know, he's ridiculous. But he kind of has these some kind of instincts about who his audience is, you know. And I think he takes them as an audience, literally, not necessarily as a public. But anyway, I don't want to keep prattling on, but I just want to throw that out. I'm curious what you all think about that, that it just seemed to me really, really striking that oddly that it's almost as if the Republicans seem to be becoming the party of the working class.
I mean, I see that from a distance. I see that also in the UK. And indeed you have it with Salvini in Italy.
Oh, like you mean in the UK, like with Brexit and so on?
Well, with Brexit and Boris Johnson, and they've just, they had a huge working class vote, and they eroded the red wall, with red being the left in the UK, and of course most of the world except for America. But the group of, as we say, constituencies, electoral constituencies that are normally all Labour that go across the north of England, that was eroded or very seriously damaged by in the last election by people voting for Johnson. It was thought because Corbyn's Labour didn't kind of state any case for or against Brexit. And that's because they were avoiding kind of being pro-Brexit effectively.
But are you assuming that the credentialed class sees things like better?
Yeah, right.
Often. I mean,
they do. I'm not there with you on that one. I think they're more brainwashed than the
working class.
Than the working class, because they've got their head in CNN.
But what you saying? Well, I don't know. What you're saying there by working class? I mean, when you say the credential class, who do you mean? In my mind,
I guess I'm going with that. You know, college degree, you know, or above.
Well, I mean, college degree now means so. It means so little now. I don't.
PMC, the PMCs, the professional
managers. PMC.
That's who. A lot of them are voting Democrats. No, voting Democrat. None of that's a good thing.
They're Democrats, and you know,
but they weren't brainwashed to vote like for the wall, for example. So
who was for the war? Trump was against
the wall.
Oh, I thought you said the war.
Yeah, because Trump's pretty anti-war. That's one thing about him.
I don't really buy that. I think that a war situation just didn't come across in his term like it did in Bush's term.
I think that's complex, but I know for a fact. I mean, I feel like the Democrats would have gotten us in a fucking war by now. You know.
Well, that's possible, but I think Trump did push back.
I agree.
Trump is anti-establishment. You know, George Bush fucking hates Trump. The Democrats' war hawks hate Trump. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Trump's in a running war with the military leadership.
Literally.
He hates people. He hates people who get killed in war and basically cowards. I mean, a large part of the military are losers because they die. So that's not really being anti-war. That's just being complete.
Look, he talked shit, but you know, he did run in 2000. I'm here. I'm like defending Trump or something. I mean,
he did run.
He did run against the Iraq war.
He's not a politician. Yeah. He doesn't understand the system, and it's not that I think he should go to war. I just don't think it's something to in his favor particularly. I think it's just a happy accident. But Hitler avoided wars for years, and people said he was a peacemaker because of how he achieved Anschluss, because of how he got the Sudetenland, etc. And people really were calling them peacemakers. I don't know how long it would take for Trump to get in a war if he was allowed another term.
So Trump has shown force, though. He has avoided traditional wars, but he has shown force in areas where you wouldn't expect such force to be shown. So I think it's just a different type. But I want to get back to some stuff, because I've been holding my tongue on this because I like the conversation. I think it's really hard to answer if Bernie would have won. I kind of lean towards he could have if the Democratic Party could have actually like been behind him and not tried to sabotage him, which is a big if, of course, because we saw how they sabotaged him during the primaries.
That's a good point. That's a good point, yeah.
But what I want to get at here is something, Tony, you said that you thought if we showed them, we wouldn't vote for them, the Dems, the establishment, the DNC, that they might take our message more seriously. And I think I used to believe that very strongly, and I don't know if I do anymore. And I think the only way to get out of that predicament is also another impossible task, which is to break the two-party systems. And I think right now we're at a moment where people, even like the Republicans, are so upset about the way that the electoral process works. And the Democratic voters have been upset like this for a long time. And I do mean the working class ones, that you could actually push for some kind of major electoral reform in the U.S. That could operate and appeal, you know, to more people than a partisan push. And, you know, we might be able to break up the two-party system that way by instituting things like, I mean, right off the top of my head, the things are like a ranked election, like instant runoff voting and automatic voter registration and the end of the Electoral College. And then standardizing the voting process across the states, which is a big thing that, you know, the Republicans are really confused about right now. They seem so confused about how, well, why is this state like this? Why is this state like this? We need to bring it all together. And we do need to bring it all together. And you can, like, actually get people behind that in a way that could break that two-party system. Because I don't think they're going to listen to anyone with farther ideas and are acceptable to them, as long as there's two parties, you know? Because
I think it
takes a lot of votes to get a third party anywhere near feasible.
I think we see a very similar thing in the UK, which has a two-party system.
I agree with Adam that there could be a sort of cross-party constituency for some structural reforms, although I think it's just vanishingly unlikely, unfortunately. I mean, we just elected a centrist institutionalist, you know, and this election is pretty widely seen as almost just like a victory for centrism, right? I mean, everybody in the center, you know, I know there were some progressive victories in sort of safe areas, but Biden has pretty much said he's not going to do anything out of the lines structurally. I mean, there's nothing in his past or his 47 years in Congress or in as vice president, there's nothing in his political past that would suggest he would try for anything like that. He's not going to, despite the coyness for even about stuff like packing the Supreme Court, he's not going to do that. You're not going to attempt to do that.
What was really funny to me is, you know, like the Biden voter kind of area is like, there'll be people that are pretty left, you know, that are pretty left wing. And like their very last thing, like if you run down the whole list with these people, you know, about the Biden issue, it's like their very last thing is like, oh, well, climate change, right? Like that's the very last, you know, like Noam Chomsky and all these fucking libs or whatever. Like, but
yeah,
it was funny. I don't know if anyone caught it. In like the middle of one of the debates, he literally says he's not for the Green New Deal. And then Trump goes, hold up, what? Is that that's news to everybody. Like, that's a big deal. Because it says that on your website, that you're for the Green New Deal. And then on the stage, Joe Biden literally said, he was like, what? I'm not for the Green New Deal. I don't know if anyone caught that. It really didn't get a lot of coverage.
There was a parallel thing with fracking and anti-fracking that was kind of news in Pennsylvania too, especially.
And Trump said, oh, you just lost the left.
Exactly.
But you know what? That's the thing, though. They didn't care. They didn't care.
They don't care about the left. They knew that the left was going to vote for them anyway. This is the thing. They can brainwash the way that the media works and the way that we can like morally try to say and then use this like fascist kind of symbolism, you know, to really hype up this moral, like morally pushing people to go out and vote or whatever. Like, oh, you're bad. You know, it's just, it's insane when you actually look at it.
And what is really the left that one would worry about electorally? I mean, as far as numbers, they kind of get most of what a lot of people would consider the left, maybe not those of us in this conversation as much, but the kind of identity politics, you know, people, they've got them, you know, and that's pretty much what quote unquote the left TM, you know, has turned into in the United States. The kind of, I don't know, socioeconomic left is pretty much an insignificant sliver of people. You know, Mike alluded to a few of them on Twitter and like a few of us on Twitter, I should say. But I think we went through this unfortunate emotional roller coaster thinking that that was a much more prominent feature of American politics during the Bernie sort of rise and fall. You know, we kind of had this moment of thinking that, oh, wow, okay. But no, it seems like it's just vanishingly small. The establishment liberals are very happy with the Id Paul sort of woke left, you know. It sits very well with corporate America.
I just want to like try and get this onto a some kind of, if not a solution, then something going towards that. And David, in your last book, What's Left of the World, you kind of say what you just said, that there is a kind of or the left has become basically identitarian. There isn't any more a materialist workers left. And you say this is because there are no longer kind of stable career identities or job identities. So how do you get around that in the book? What do you end up proposing?
Well, I don't have like any proposals for electoral politics for that.
Sure, but I mean, electoral politics.
I don't think that's solved.
Sure, but David, I mean, electoral politics aren't going to work. We're just going to have to do something that is going to work.
I think it's something much more akin to a moral religious revival of some kind than it is electoral politics. But that's putting things in a very tight, unsatisfactory nutshell.
Well, yeah, kind of. But I mean, I'm not saying that your thinking is unsatisfactory or that it fits in a nutshell.
Well, I would be the first to admit that my thinking is unsatisfactory.
Okay, okay. Well, that's thank you. But on a wider level, I'm not really pointing the finger at you. It's just saying that our collective thinking is unsatisfactory, and you just happen to be part of that.
That's my premise of operation from that book.
I think a lot of us have got to like, nothing's working, but then what flows on from that? I mean, some of us might feel we can just kind of sit it out till we go, so to speak. There are younger people out there who might want to like try and change things. I mean, is there any hope out there? You talk about left candidates winning, but you say that's mostly in safe Senate seats and in the other house. But I mean, we have this AOC, which I know, Tony, you're not convinced by her at all, Alessandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anyone in the party?
I'm not convinced by her either, by the way.
Okay, so just explain that, both of you, because I mean, a lot of people do really like AOC.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
What's the problem with her? What don't you like about her? Let's just say that.
Well, I guess the main thing is like, you know, the idea of like critique the people closest to you in politics, right? But I guess it's more of just like, you know, like the Green New Deal has a lot of sketchy things, you know, and it's more of like how these people like play these kind of like symbolic roles. And also her like riding with Biden, being pro Biden. I don't know. It's just like, she kind of came in being like, oh, you know, I'm anti the Democratic establishment. I'm like, you know, same thing with Bernie. And then look what these people did. Look what these people did to us, how they turned their back on us. And just, I mean, I don't know. With Bernie, it was especially sad. It felt like he just let these people slap him around.
Well, yeah, she did nominate Bernie at the Congress, Democratic Congress, which is only symbolic at that point, but she didn't have to do that. And it did leave her open to criticism. And then she's just really slated by that. I mean, criticized the Dems in the New York Times the other day, just after the election. And she really was very, very strong in her condemnation of the Democratic establishment. So I don't think it's entirely.
She's like
fair.
Pro Nancy, Nancy Pelosi, and
yeah. I mean, I wonder, like, what does one do in that position, though? I mean, once you're kind of in the system, I mean, these people have some kind of symbolic value in terms of speaking up for a position that's further left than the main party. Do you not see any value in that?
Oh, of course. Well, like, obviously, like, AOC, I guess the idea is, like, how these people come into the kind of game or whatever, and, like, you know, she was, like, supposed to be this socialist progressive, you know, and then I guess the whole thing is, like, you get everybody hyped up that this is some real socialist lady, and then she ends up not being. It's way more disappointing.
Because the country isn't socialist. I mean, she can't be socialist. The most she can be socialist is by saying...
Well, working class, pro-working class. The country's pro-working class. I mean, you can't get past that. We don't have to call it socialist or whatever. But I think that's why Bernie almost fucking won, is or why he was going to win against Biden in the primary, was because he you know, even Bernie was too lib for me in the 2020. I think that's why he ultimately lost. I think if he was more pro-working class like he was in 2016, I think he'd have a better chance.
But, I mean, all these people are too lib for all of us, but Bernie's as far left as one can be.
And no, I think he ran two different campaigns, 2016 and 2020. In 2020, it definitely seemed like he was way more identity politics and way more liberal and way more attached to the Democratic establishment. I mean, I don't know.
I'm seeing that as just a tactic to get elected so that you have a...
Well, I think that was a bad tactic.
In the end. You know what I mean?
I think that was a bad tactic.
I guess I'm right at this point, if you ask for like, okay, is there anything to be hopeful about? And you all might be horrified by what I'm about to say, but I guess I'm a little more interested in populists that are kind of rejecting a lot of the kind of Democratic, Republican, left-right sort of divide. And so, for example, I think even within the Republicans, there's kind of a battle between the kind of establishment institutionalist types that might be represented in the next, like if you imagine like post-Trump Republicans, someone like Nikki Haley, you know, or someone like that would kind of represent like the Bush, you know, wing, the kind of establishment, traditional Republicans. But then there's also people like Josh Hawley, who's a senator from Missouri, who I think kind of, he's super religious. He's very culturally sort of right wing in terms of his religiosity and stuff. Like if you look on his Twitter feed, he's always starting the day with like a Bible quote, you know, in the morning and stuff. But he's, I think, much more authentically populist than a lot of the sort of celebrity Democrats are, as far as what he makes central to his, at least his political rhetoric, are the forces that are disintegrating communities. You know, he speaks out against, you know, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, the opioid epidemic in the middle of the country, you know, these sorts of things. And I don't know. I think that's maybe more interesting than the kind of AOC squad sort of celebrity coming out of already very Democratic, heavily Democratic areas. I'm kind of interested in what I think would be the most interesting, truly threatening thing to establishment power is if we could actually have some kind of cross, some sort of populist cross-party alliance. And there's been bubblings of this in recent American history. So for example, in 2008, that bailout, remember when they did the bailout, it was before Obama came in, but there was a left-right coalition of the far left and the far right in the US Congress that actually defeated the bailout of the banks on the first go round. But then after some heavy arm twisting, they barely got it through after that. But so I think structurally there's something interesting that's possible along those lines that maybe would take some people by surprise, but I kind of have my eye on.
Yeah. Okay. Adam.
Oh, yes, you're great.
I think we're being used there. No, I think we're being used there. I think that working class rhetoric from the right wing populist is not sincere. You know, like let's look at someone like Tucker Carlson. Sure, you could say he's you know, a right wing populist and he talks about the working class and stuff. But the more you know, if you're looking at it beyond a surface level, it's not the working. It's not all of the working class. You know, it's a specific portion, and it's tied in with a white identitarianism. You know,
okay.
I think Adam's pretty much restating what I said earlier is that the working class are basically kind of derailed from addressing the problems of capitalism by being frightened by the establishment of foreigners, etc. And this isn't really a viable working class movement. To say Trump appeals to the working class, he doesn't really appeal to them. He terrifies them, and then they go to him because he's just terrified them. So I don't think this is like an appeal to the working class that we should emulate.
They speak to the working class in a small section, and they do address some problems, but I just feel like they're superficial.
I mean, the thing is with me is, okay, what is the deal with working class people being being like meaning the same thing as white people, you know, like there's not right. black working class people. You know, I think even Mexican working class people are like anti, not anti-immigration, but like anti-open borders.
I guess, yeah. Mike, I guess I don't go with you. Maybe it sounds like maybe Tony are agreeing a little bit here. I mean, I just can't go with you on this assumption that like, oh, they're pretty much racist. That's why they're populist, or that's why they voted for Trump. I don't think that group is as racist as.
I don't think Trump is pushing a racist line like that unless he thinks he's getting votes and unless he thinks it's crucial to the marginal states. Because I don't think Trump needs to be racist. He has a foreign wife and he has worked with so many non-white and foreign people in America and not just abroad, that I think he's pushing that line because there's evidence that that can get him votes. And that is getting votes. That is getting a certain portion of the white working class. And it's not to say that all the working class are white and all the working class are racist, but that is a group that can tip elections, which is why they're cynically doing it. Do you see the difference?
I get there. So there's like it's confusing because you can have a working class like Mexican person, you know, and you know, I guess like the thing with open borders, you know, if they're already here, you know, that could fuck up their material reality. You know what I'm saying? Because of the economy. And unions and shit like that. But I guess the idea is like, you know, and this is a huge thing in like probably, I mean, like the UK from what I hear too, is like, you know, there's this conflict with like, yes, working class people and open borders, you know, and like the idea that this has to be race, that these people are racist and not just acting in their material interests. And I get my whole thing with the borders, with the immigration thing is like, you know, if like these like global superpowers nations weren't like fucking up other countries and bombing other countries, then maybe we wouldn't have an immigration problem. But the liberal kind of dynamic is like, no, we need to bomb these countries and force them to come to our country and you know, like lower you know, the price of labor and shit, you know. And of course that's better for the ruling elites. You know?
Yeah, if it's ever been put literally as let's bomb these countries so that people come to our country to work for us. But yeah, they do.
Well, they don't need to come here too. It's just there's a global labor arbitrage of outsourcing, and people understand that competition, that they're competing with, you know, work in East Asia to the bottom.
I get your points that the working class are not all racist, but your idea that they are actually materialist, they're voting for their material interests, doesn't really hold up because they're not at all voting for their material interests in voting for a kind of, you know, well, a capitalist basically, but a right-aligning capitalist. They would be voting
for
their interest if they were...
Yeah, well, how do the...
It's not always Biden, but where is the sizable amount of the working class saying what we need is to end capitalism in our material interests? They're not voting for the material interest because they're not educated to know what the material interest is. I think
they're educated enough to maybe see that Trump is probably a little better in their material interests. I think people can be educated enough to fucking see that. You know,
I agree with that. I think you're, I don't know, Mike, you're like, for well, it's like this where you're really wanting, like, I don't know, where is it? Is the working class they're just dumb? They don't understand
I'm the working class one here, Mike, David. David, where is
yeah. I mean...
David, hang on.
How is the Democratic Party?
No, but you've got to let me answer that because I actually am from a working class background, whereas you're not.
Yeah, but what you just said applies to the other classes too, doesn't it?
It does apply to other classes as well. There are very few people who really know what capitalism is, but we're talking about the working class. But you want to talk about the middle class, we can also say the middle class also aren't really going with their interests. But I don't think we can say the working class are voting with their interest in voting for Trump. I think that's, I mean, how do we get to that from Trump and Biden are equally as bad because they're all neoliberals. It's too...
Okay, let's take it a step.
Trump is in the interest of the working class. I think, you know, there's a risk here that what we're actually saying with a chance to say something is that Trump is good for the working class or the working class are voting, for, you know, for a positive thing in voting for Trump. But I don't think that's really what you mean at all. I don't think that the working class are at all voting out of a position of strength or of really knowing what's happening. I don't think they have to be stupid for that to be the case, because I think the mechanism in the media that distorts people's reality is very, very advanced. So it's not a question of someone being stupid. I'm saying the media, you've got,
I know it's false,
working
it's
in psychology.
Money. Yeah, but the media is pro Biden. The media is very obviously liberal. Most
well,
of
yeah, obviously the media is liberal, but so I think that the media being liberal does not mean that the working class are able to vote in their interest in voting for Trump. I don't think that's in their interest.
Well, look, let's say, okay, are you going to vote for Bernie or are you going to vote for Trump? Then let's say the working class votes for Trump. Okay, I can see how they're not voting for their interests. But if you have Biden versus Trump and the working class goes fuck, or, you know, Biden, or I mean, Trump versus Hillary Clinton, and then they vote for Trump, well, I would say, yeah, that might be voting for their interests in a little bit. You know, there probably is certain trade policies that Donald Trump has that's going to help the working class.
Yeah, but I think you have to look at the history of the working class. It's an isolated situation. The history of the working class voting for the right, which really goes back to Thatcher, at least in the UK. And I think this is kind of the advent of...
Yeah, because like, you know, neoliberalism.
Neoliberalism, which stole the working class vote. And I don't think you could say the working class were voting in their interest in voting for Thatcher. What happened with Thatcher is in privatizing things, she offered people, for example, one very good example, very concrete example, is how Thatcher basically offered people to buy the public housing stock. So the council houses, which are publicly owned, which are cheap for working class people. She said to people, do you want to continue having this public housing stock, which anyone can have for an affordable price, you know, as a worker? Or would you rather buy your own house? So this is basically Thatcherism as such. And in putting that choice to people, people said, I'd rather buy my own house. So a lot of the public housing stock got bought up by working class people who then thought they were voting or acting in their interest. And this is basically the same kind of logic they would apply when they voted for Thatcher. You can have some, you can have your own thing. So we jettison the socialist ideal, and you can potentially have just more stuff on your own. You might do, it's a bit like a lottery, but at least you might get all this stuff rather than having a reasonable kind of livable portion of stuff guaranteed to you and all of your co-workers. And then people, when they offered that, they go for the, well, I'll risk possibly getting rich rather than continuing having public housing stock or public services, etc. Now, is that the working class voting in the working class interest? It's not. It's a working class voting in an individualist interest. Yeah. So I think on that token that the working class voting conservative again and again since the late 70s, early 80s is not the working class voting in their interest. I think that's what we have today still. Do you see the distinction?
Yeah.
Well, in American politics, I'm not sure that the vast majority doesn't really have the option to vote in their material interests. Right. I mean, how many people are voting in their material interests, maybe like 10% of the PMC class or something like that, are voting in their material interests. So I think it's important to understand, like, I don't know, the psychological appeal. And I think it really is missing it to just say, oh, it's just the racism or something like that. I think,
yeah, I agree with you.
I think there's a lot more going on. So let me try one thing out for you that I think is important that we maybe haven't talked about so much. I think one thing that, One source of Trump's appeal for the uncredentialed, let's say, that also is a source of ire against him on the part of the credentialed, is that I think in a way he gives the lie to meritocracy. You know, I've always felt that because, like, you know, when I think of people around me in universities and wealthy types who have such a absolute hatred for Trump. I mean, it seems way disproportionate to his policies or anything like that. It's him, it's his personality, his rhetoric, his just demeanor, his, you know, and what explains this, you know, unbelievable sort of extra sort of, hatred for Trump. And I've often felt that one of the things it does is it it gives the lie to meritocracy in a way, because here is Trump is actually an Ivy League educated guy, you know, believe it or not. He's sort of somehow it's an insult to the very idea of the meritocracy that these people sort of credit with their own, you know, the legitimacy of their own position in society. That if this buffoon can be at the apex of the system, you know, then it means that maybe the system really isn't that meritocratic. You know, if such a boorish, you know, unmannered, you know, fellow, you know, can be at the top and can win the top position at the apex, that maybe the meritocracy is kind of a sham. You know, maybe it's a little bit more of a mirage. And I think the people on the uncredentialed side of the fence kind of see this, you know, and they kind of view Trump as like, you know, they're watching, it's like watching wrestling. It's like, he's kind of the champion. He's like, they get a cathartic enjoyment of seeing him wreck the pointy heads, you know, on cable news, the coastal elites, the academics, the elites in the military, which is very much to be distinguished from the rank and file in the military. There's just a cathartic enjoyment factor of seeing him not take them seriously and sort of deflate them with his, you know, crudity and his outrageous statements and so on and so forth. And it kind of, I think, sort of punctures this idea in a way of, like I said, meritocracy, where they're made to feel that, like, well, they're just failures and they fucked up in the world. They fucked up and they deserve their place because they just didn't study hard enough in school, or they didn't, you know, do the right things. And I think Trump kind of performs that kind of symbolic, psychological sort of cathartic sort of function for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that's
oh yeah.
Go on, Tony. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, I was going to say, like, yeah, I 100% agree with that. And, you know, that's like even looking at like symbolic and kind of cultural level. But then, I mean, if you get down to like brass tacks, you know, and you're actually like, if you think about a working class person, you know, and let's say, okay, so Mike, actually, here's a quick question. Like,
yeah,
you do agree that, okay, you can have a working class person. Okay, actually, this stat right here proves this, what I'm about to say is that, like how many Trump voters were ex-Obama voters, like people that voted for Obama twice and then went and voted for Trump. Like how many people there were that did that?
Yeah, this is
so like, I think there's plenty of Trump voters that are moderate, regular people that are not racist.
But I think I have to address this because this has gone on like for half the program, and I never said that all working class are racist. I said the worry is that Labour in the UK start reacting to the perception that a number of voters voted for Brexit, okay, and this was perceived to be a xenophobic vote, and that they think that we should now pander to this. But I didn't say all working class are racist. I just said that there is this perception, there is what we call blue Labour emerging or re-emerging, this idea of a blue Labour, a Tory Labour, a patriotic Labour that panders to patriotism and nationalism in the working classes. And as that's not what the Labour movement is really about, I'm just saying, should we pander to an idea which is manipulated by the media to gain votes for the right? So, you know, then people become right. More xenophobic. Then they vote on that basis. Then Labour say, oh, we need to listen to the working class, i.e. be more xenophobic. And I'm saying, does that make any sense? Because it's not the working class being xenophobic. It's the right wing pushing them that way through manipulation. And they've had centuries of experience on how to kind of frighten the working classes, the poor, the peasants before that, through scapegoating people. So I never said, you're caricaturing.
Okay, yeah, no, sorry. I wouldn't say that you think all working class people are racist. I'm kind of still going by what you just said right there. But like, think about, you know, you have a working class person in America, you know, and then like the open borders talk with the Democrats or whatever. I could easily see a person that's not horribly racist, not saying that you're saying they're all racist, but I can easily see a very moderate, regular person, maybe even someone who used to vote for Obama two times, you know what I'm saying, sit there and go, man, now that when I'm really looking at these people's policies, I really think Trump's in my material interests, things like trade, you know. So, I mean, I think it's a little more complex than just saying these working class people are not voting in their their interests at all.
Especially when you're sitting there and you're sitting there and you're watching your own community deteriorate.
Yeah, but to address Tony, what I just said, it's not that they don't vote in their interest, but it's a distortion of what their interest is. So what I was trying to say with Thatcherism, which is really the beginning of neoliberalism, is that, you know, there's a kind of a conflation between working class interest and the interest of individual working class people. You see what I mean? The potential to, which is already kind of the American dream anyway, that you might become rich at the expense of your fellow working class people. Someone could see that as voting in their interest, no?
I'm not sure if that's the exact situation with the Donald Trump versus Biden or Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton.
It's not really with Donald Trump. It's not with Donald Trump versus Biden, no. It's with Donald Trump and Biden versus any real left wing, I suppose. But that's why I don't think voting for Trump is really voting in any working class interest. Because I understand you say, okay, so it's better than voting for Biden. I mean, possibly. I don't know, because you're dealing with somebody. We're dealing with somebody who now won't concede an election. So I don't know that we can really say this would be in anyone's interest, that we're now seeing his true colors. What a lot of people are saying could happen, that he basically wants to be a type of monarch, that you're seeing that emerge. So how can Trump be in anyone's interest in that respect? But that's a slightly different issue. But going on to the rhetoric and people seeing Trump as vulgar, which David is saying, I understand that part of this is like he goes against bourgeois sensibilities, and I find that's kind of funny because the bourgeois are screwing us over anyway, or the
that's
bourgeois
great, yeah.
And the elite. But on the other hand, there's a degree to which in his rhetoric he basically he does threaten democracy. Through his kind of willingness to, rather than go along with normal arguments, to just kind of like play the fool and kind of throw away any possibility of a normal kind of a linear dialogue. I think that is dangerous. So this is not the same as just being vulgar. It's being vulgar and ripping up democratic norms. I think that's a little bit different.
I think Tony might have also been throwing me in there with you, Mike, when I said that if you look at a lot of right-wing populism, most of it relies on a white identitarianism. And I think a lot of that's true if you think of it culturally as well. I'm not saying that the working class is racist by any means, or all of them, of course. I am working class. You know, I am not a credentialed person. I work with a young black woman who supports BLM, voted for Trump, and believes in QAnon.
Queen.
No, I mean that's not a coherent ideology, right? That is not an interest that is a class interest. She does not, a lot of that time, that is not thinking of the working class as a class, at all. They, you know, a lot of these people wouldn't even, know the word working class besides the idea that we're speaking of it. And I'm not trying to say that they're stupid, by any means. I'm saying it's a different frame of reference, and that is not a shared frame of reference there. And so I think that's the difference with what y'all are talking about. Like Mike is talking about how they could be embracing personal interest. And yes, they could be embracing personal interest, but they're not embracing class interest. I don't know. I see a difference there.
Yeah. They're working class people are embracing personal interest, but they're not.
It gets
not
complex in there, the trying to discern class. Like the difference.
Well, I think there is a difference. I think it's a basic, like, do you want to, you say to some kids playing, like, you know, stop being horrible, stop keeping everything to yourself. You have to share your toys, but you have to tell them, you know what I mean? But the kid who's playing might think it's in my interest to grab all the toys for myself. You know what I mean? Or the toy that everyone wants to play with. I want to keep it for myself. And that's a bit like socialism, though, that you're saying, yeah, well, you might want all that, but, you know, to make the best society work in everyone's interest, we need to kind of, you know, manage how this wealth is going around. And, you know, a lot of working class people might just think, I want my part, grab. I want to grab it. And then also at the risk that they might not actually get their part because there won't be maybe protections afforded to them to you know, in the event that something goes wrong, they lose their job or whatever. You know, this idea of like, let's just have a free fall and all grab rather than sharing might actually be dangerous even to the individual who prefers that kind of that approach.
So do you think Trump is that individualist kind of idea, like grab what you can personally, comparably to Biden?
I don't know your welfare system and who is offering what in terms of welfare. So that's, I don't know, who is there any difference? Are they offering any change from the existing welfare system, or is it any way federal?
A lot of it, yeah, a lot of it is federal. And I would say, I mean, the Trump and his administration, who are heavily, you know, he can talk about anti-elitism and draining the swamp, yet his administration is heavily Republican and establishment Republican. He's at odds with some of them for sure. But in many ways, he's fulfilling a lot of the Republican promises for the last 30, 40 years. There is a dismantling of the welfare system. There's a dismantling of environmental protections. So, I mean, maybe you could say in short-term interest, but in long-term interest, I don't see it. I understand what you mean, though, Tony, about like trade policies and some of that stuff. And I think they certainly speak the rhetoric of some of that interest.
No,
and I don't
yeah,
see
I think
it
the trade
actually
policy,
following through.
I think that, I think, you know, there's like not a lot of difference between Biden and Trump. Also, like, here's the one thing that's super interesting. The Biden, like, everyone kind of, I've seen a kind of a colloquial agreement, like, around, like, okay, like, Biden sucks, you know, there is no difference, fuck it, some people's like, shit, we might, like, as a leftist, there are people saying, fuck, I might vote for Trump or whatever, but the only thing with the Biden thing is, like, you know, the environment shit, but man, is like the environment shit and climate change kind of shit really sketchy, you know, with like, I don't know, like Silicon Valley and shit like that and the kind of tech industry.
Yeah.
I think, so that's what I'm saying. I think we're talking about super complex, you know, stuff, but I think when it really does come down to like working class interests, there's not a lot of difference between these people, but Trump does have, you know, upper hand on trade, I would say. You know, I mean, China and...
I'm not denying that. I mean, it's quite plausible that Trump is better for some working class people, that they may feel they're voting in their material interest in voting Trump, but it's not a material interest as opposed to a genuine alternative to both of them.
And Bernie would have been, right? But he lost. So if we are going versus Biden versus Trump, I think that, fuck yeah. I mean, working class, I can easily see working class people reasonably going, you know what, both these guys suck, but Trump might be a little better for me, you know, as a working class person. Like, I don't think that's horribly crazy or against their material interests or racist, you know. I think that's, I can easily see how a reasonable person can come to a reasonable conclusion like that to vote for Trump. Especially when the other guy is fucking Biden, who has been fucking spending like half his career trying to take away Social Security. I mean, do people forget this shit? You know, Trump has not been spending half his fucking life trying to take away Social Security. You know, so I can see some working class people going, shit, you know, Trump might be better. Like, is that crazy to say?
Well, so I want to say that that David had to go, so he won't be on the rest of the call. But Tony, so I understand what you're saying there, but I want to ask you this: is that just looking at Trump in the way that maybe you're also thinking that people are looking at Biden? Like, is he really there in that interest? Like, or is it just the same kind of mirage where we would think that Biden is, or that people would argue that Biden was for their interest? Like, it doesn't seem to me that he's actually fighting for that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, we're already taking it as a given that both these guys suck, right?
Sure, okay, okay.
I mean, it's not like I'm sitting here supporting Trump, right?
But I think in that respect, I think that the it's almost a philosophical argument, because it's like, we don't really like either of them, so couldn't the conversation be more about what we can do instead?
Right, yeah. The election just happened, and, you know, we're like, I think it's just people are caught up in this Biden-Trump thing. But obviously, like, thinking, you know, more structurally and more long-term, that's just more complex, you know. But it's fun to argue about the Biden-Trump thing.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's an interesting point, and it does have relevance to how people
vary
going forward.
Yeah, and of course, recently with the election and stuff, you know. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I suppose it's just a question. I suppose also we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon. But yeah, I mean, what can people do? I mean, I don't suppose your argument is embrace Trump, and obviously you're not pro Biden, and we don't think Sanders, well, he's not going to run again. I don't think you don't like AOC, and we don't think that kind of end of politics probably will ever be successful in terms of electoral victory. So where does that leave us?
In a hell world, absolute hell world, black pilled. I guess you can just say what people have been saying. Yeah, like, oh, we have to, you know, ever since Bernie dropped out, you know, this has been the discourse. Like, fuck, you know, we have to go back to, you know, because the left, this is what people kind of seem to forget in, like, these last 4 years. Like, the left or the socialist communist left are never fucking people that are going out and voting. Okay, this has just been like this is a really recent thing in, like, communist history of in America, of, like, and a little bit with Corbyn, is like, oh, maybe us communists should go out and vote, you know, with Bernie and then with Corbyn or whatever. Because previous to that, I mean, it was not a thing that communists were voting. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, to me, Bernie was already the what is it called? Like, he was already someone that we were going, oh, okay, he's not the best, but fuck it, he's good enough to go out and vote. And then thinking about, like, Biden is someone that, you know, communists should go out and vote is, like, ridiculous to me. You know, Bernie was already supposed to be the guy that's like, yeah, he's a lib, he's not, like, all the way there, but he's just good enough, you know, so maybe we should go out and vote.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, like, it was the stakes. So it's the stakes in letting Trump have another term. And I think the thing is, everyone was saying, some people were saying, this is exaggerated that he's fascist and, you know, really wouldn't be any different with Biden. But then the way he starts trying to hold on to his election, it immediately exonerates those people who voted specifically to get rid of a potential fascist or someone who...
What about how Nancy Pelosi said, if Trump wins, then they were not going to let that happen? Nancy Pelosi had, like, some tweet or something like that. Very fascist-like tweet.
Yeah, well, she's emotional and she doesn't want him to win. I mean, that's like...
Well, okay, so yeah, I mean, this is my thing with calling Trump a fascist.
Whether she really would have not let him win in the event that he convincingly won, I don't think Pelosi would be able to stand in the way. I don't think Trump can even stand in the way of him going.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
With all he's going to put behind it. But it does demonstrate that he doesn't have democracy at all, you know.
Neither of these, I think Trump's a fascist just as much as Nancy Pelosi is.
I think democracy is, like, what it offers is really threadbare. It doesn't really offer anything in terms of freedom, but it offers, you know, it's the most we've ever been offered. And so to pedal back on that and just have fascism or dictatorship, I think would be a wrong move. I mean, we can really risk that and what might come about.
Well, this is like some Jules Deleuze kind of society of control type shit. Is like, you have this kind of pseudo democracy. Like, what's more dangerous? Like, them giving you the idea that you have democracy? I don't think Trump's a fascist. Let me just say that.
Totalitarian states, though, you look at what goes on in totalitarian states, and it's really not good. I mean, in terms of, like, rounding up and disappearing any kind of opposition to the government, I mean, you don't want to be in that position. surely.
Right.
I mean, the argument is that in Western democracies, they actually were doing pretty much that, but they were doing it in their colonies. So, of course, that is bad. And now, you know, with kind of post-colonialism, globalization, there's certainly people living in terrible conditions, you know, so that we can live in good conditions in our kind of threadbare democracies. I mean, there's no kind of perfect answer, but I mean, I think we can't doubt that we don't want to go there in terms of totalitarianism in the States or the UK. And Boris Johnson just banned tuition of anti-capitalist material in schools. You can't teach anything, you can't teach anything with an anti-capitalist message. So I think, you know, I think the thing is the Pandora's box has been opened. I mean, this isn't going to go away. Trump has demonstrated that you could potentially end American democracy. And there are kind of maneuvers in this direction in the UK. So we're going to have to fight hard to avoid that. And that's what
I think it's kind of dangerous to call Trump a fascist, though.
I mean, it depends what he does, of course. I mean, but this last thing of not letting go of power is not a good look. And it's trying to stir up.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, but then Nancy Pelosi, you can't just say, oh, Nancy Pelosi, when she said it, she was joking or whatever, right? Like,
well, I think it's very easy to take a stand against Nancy Pelosi. You know, I don't know any like social democratic leftist that's like, oh, but Nancy Pelosi, though, you know, you have to be.
No, but she's like, the democratic establishment, though, you know, and
said
if Trump wins, we're not going to let him, or she said something like that. I mean, I could probably pull up the tweet, but.
Right. But I'm saying I don't see the people like actually falling behind that.
Yeah, well,
I do think Trump has. Like, I don't know. I would call him a proto-fascist or flirting with that. I think he entertains and gives credence to ideas even further right than he is. But yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think he's literally a fascist in a coherent ideological sense.
Yeah, and I think it's just a word that we can use to fear-monger people into voting for the opposition party.
Well, I think there are also like worrying signs and things he was doing that looked a bit like what fascists did before they became full-on fascist, before they became dictatorial fascists. So, I mean, there are historical parallels with the kind of things he was doing and saying, and there are with Boris Johnson and his government.
I mean, I think you can find those parallels with fucking Obama, you know, the first black president, you know what I'm saying? Like, but... Well, I mean, think about it. Like, you know, like Obama, didn't Obama deport more Mexicans? Didn't he deport more people than Trump?
Well, I don't know if that's the exact statistics. It was said at a point, but I don't know whether that was like, oh, I mean.
Obama, I mean, he's killed more people in the Middle East than Trump. I mean, who's the fascist whenever it comes down to actually killing people?
It's going into the Iraq war and then maintaining the Iraq war was something that was the hawks in the government and in the military establishment and the arms trade that were pushing for that was pretty much inevitable. I'm not defending anyone who went along with that, but I don't know if...
I'm not defending anyone either. I'm not defending Trump. I'm just saying
you can't,
that...
It's not really... You can't really compare presidents across different terms. It's very difficult.
Okay, I get what you're saying, because there's historical context, you know, to it.
Yeah, but I'm not defending Obama. How do you say this? Obama. I'm not defending this guy. The thing is, like, there's been this erosion of civil liberties like creeping across the West for decades and really very strongly since 9/11. And it's gone through left and right governments. It is worrying. I think you're right. Yeah. I think this is one continuum across both parties. That can't be doubted. Yeah.
So Tony, can I push you and ask you again? 'Cause David answered me and I understood, but I didn't like his answer. But can I push you on my wingnut idea of trying to actually split the party by massive electoral reform?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course. I think that'd be a good idea. I mean, it's just, I guess the idea is like, how do you go about doing that?
That's true. That's what makes it very, very hard.
Who would vote in the electoral reforms that are against their own interests? So it doesn't seem plausible.
Well, they would be in the interest of people, especially if they believe
The Republican and Democratic Party, they wouldn't want.
Yeah, of the base, they would be. So, all right, there you bring in what, you know, this was a left criticism of the Bernie campaign was, well, how are you going to do a lot of this stuff? And Bernie's answer was something like, well, we have the people demand it. And, you know, you could say that's not realistic, and maybe it's not. But if you have large amounts of people, and I'm talking mass amounts of people, like at least one third of the population demanding this kind of thing, maybe you can have some kind of movement on that. Because I think it would be in people's interest just by being able to better express themselves. And I think, I mean, I don't know, it's probably a bias here, but I think you would see a larger left parties emerge out of that. Because I think we have to split the Democratic Party, and it's dangerous to do that if the Republican is in such a strong position, and pretty impossible when it's just the system that we have now. I don't see how you can do it. You're not going to raise one of the third parties. You're not going to raise one of the small socialist parties. You're not going to raise the Green Party. You know, these seem like dead ends, and I've voted for these parties before, you know, and volunteered and done stuff like that. But I don't see it raising to some kind of mass party.
I'm hearing you. I'm just thinking, we're going to have to wrap up soon. I'm just thinking that really needs a grassroots movement. The only option is to circumvent the mainstream media and grow up a movement by going and speaking to people on the streets, so to speak, in their workplaces, etc. I can't see any other possibility. And that is something that that left Dems are doing. And what do you call it? Democratic Socialists, DS, is it DSA?
Yeah, the
DSA. And then there's definitely a big explosion of like grassroots sentiment and tactics in the UK and US in the last few years under Corbyn and with the Sanders movement. And hopefully this is something that can grow. I can't see any other possibility because even the internet, there was this potential of, oh, wow, you know, anyone can publish on the internet. We can circumvent mass media, but then it's being all screwed up by algorithms. So we're not able really to get a message across to the masses like that. So yeah, I think grassroots on the ground movements, maybe we need to engage that and push that as kind of left internet people. But I mean, it's great. It's been great to have you. We kind of came here to try and unite the left. We arguably didn't this time, but we can meet again. I'm sure we have much more to talk about. So let's talk here or on your channel soon, Tony.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'll have both of you on next time.
That would be great. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Oh hell yeah. No, yeah, this was great. I really, this was actually really great.